And we've got David Darling this hour. We're going to take your phone calls with him. We're talking about catastrophes. We're talking about things in space. He's the astronomer. And we'll be back with David and your calls on Coast to Coast AM. David, we talked about the possibility that the Mayans could have had some extraterrestrial help. Who knows? My take and my question, if a civilization grows at the rate we're going, and they're a million years ahead of us, is it conceivable that they could have developed some kind of propulsion system to bend space and time and get to places in an instant?
Oh, I think so. I'm sure that there are, personally, I'm sure that there are ways to get around the light barrier. In theory, we already know of them, as you just mentioned there, by manipulating space and time. And a million years is a heck of a long time. Perhaps we'll have that technology even within a few centuries.
That's true.
And certainly, if you look out into the wider galaxy, and I believe that there are many civilizations out there. I'm a real optimist when it comes to life in space, and intelligent life in particular. Some astronomers disagree with me on that. They think that although life might be common, advanced life might be very, very rare. I don't see any reason for that to be the case. So I suspect that intelligence is a relatively common factor out there. And most technological civilizations in the galaxy will be far ahead of us because we have only had advanced technology for the past century or two. If you're talking about things like computers and powered flight and spacecraft, we're new kids on the block. So certainly any races out there are very likely to be far ahead of us, and I would think are capable of breaking the light barrier and getting here pretty quickly if they wanted to.
And if this primordial soup is the same throughout the universe, it's got to be very conceivable that intelligent life has got to be out there somewhere. I mean, I just think it all develops at the same rate and pace.
Well, I would find it a lot more surprising if it weren't.
If it was not, that's right.
Yeah, if we were alone, I'd find that amazing. I would think, well, why? You know, what was so special about the Earth? And I don't really see that as the case. I mean, intelligence it takes many forms on our own planet. We're not the only intelligent species. We may be the only ones that makes tools, but if you look in the ocean, you find creatures that have brains bigger than ours. We've got the great apes. Many birds are intelligent. The octopus is an incredibly intelligent animal, which has evolved along quite different lines. The only thing that stops the octopus is it has such a short lifespan. If it lived as long as we did, it might have a technology or a civilization under the sea, for all we know. So, intelligence is not a one-off thing on this planet. It's emerged many, many times. And if we weren't the most intelligent species here, then something else would be and would have probably evolved technology as well. I don't see any reason, any factors that are stopping it from happening elsewhere.
That's exciting if we ever get to this point where we definitively know.
Yeah, and I suspect it won't be that long in coming. We only have to look at the exoplanet discoveries to realize that we're going to know about thousands, tens of thousands, eventually millions of planets out there, and we're going to be able to look at them in detail with future instruments, and we're going to be able to look for signs of life and intelligent life. So I think it's quite possible we'll find it that way, if not by any other means.
David, I had a story when you were on hold before you even came on about genetically engineered mosquitoes that they're going to let loose in the Keys in Florida. Is that a good idea?
I don't know. I mean, there's no way of really testing these things on a large scale until you actually do it. That's the problem. You can study them in the lab, but it's not really a complete ecosystem. So I think that's what people are worried about, is what's going to be the wider effects, unknown spin-offs from this type of thing. And I think that's a valid concern. There's been many cases of animals, small and larger perhaps than mosquitoes, being released into the wild. It's happened in Australia, for example, with the with the cane toads, which are now taking over the country. You know, they have unforeseen consequences sometimes. You release these things with all the good intentions, but then somehow they affect the food chain in ways that you didn't really predict, or they have just some unforeseen consequences that you couldn't model in the lab. So I think that's what people are concerned about, for a very good reason. Yeah.
Okay, to the phones we go. Let's pick it up by going to Josh in Donna, Texas. Hey, Josh, go ahead. You're on with David Darling.
Hello?
Yeah, go ahead, Josh.
Oh, hi. Great show tonight. I was just wondering, does the gravity of one planet affect the electromagnetic field of another, like possibly Planet X affecting the Earth's poles, causing them to shift? Because I remember seeing documentaries on Nibiru, and they say that it actually comes from underneath our solar system and goes over us. So if it's a big planet, bigger than Earth, I would think the gravitational pull of it could possibly, you know, alter our poles if it does have an effect. I was just wondering if it does.
Okay, well, we've got, you talked about two different things, that gravity, which is one type of force, and electromagnetism, which is another, and the two do not interact directly. Gravity does not affect. Now, what I'm just hypothesizing here, so if you had a very, very powerful gravitational field near to the Earth, it could affect motions in the Earth's core, which is where the planet's magnetic field is generated, gotcha. Basically. So it's possible that, you know, if you had violent tugging on the core, and I'm just throwing this out for you, then yes, it could have some effect on the magnetic field. So the two fields are not interacting directly, but it's the mass effect on the core which will then indirectly affect the electromagnetic field. And I suppose any disturbances to that could possibly trigger a pole reversal. It's a very, 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 very unlikely sequence of events, because first of all, that other planet would have to come so close that we would have more things to worry about than the pole reversal. It would have major surface effects as well. But there is a possible link there, yes.
Okay, thanks for that, David. Let's go next to Hampton, Virginia. It's Rodney's turn on Coast to Coast. Hey, Rodney, go ahead.
Hi, George. David, last week I got bored and I started taking some photographs of the sun through some filtered glass, and I zoomed in about 20 times and noticed there was a dark circle of little dots. I thought it was my camera. I tried a number of photographs in a series and got to noticing that the sun was blinking. And I got to looking at all the little dots, and they were dancing so quickly every 3 seconds as I took photographs in a series, zigging and zagging and twirling and dancing around in front of the sun. I thought it was a swarm of bees, but upon closer inspection each day over the past 10 days that I've been taking a series of photos, it's very clear that there's a number like 24 dots that will be found. This apparently is something associated with Planet X and the moons that are said to be number 24 in total. I just wanted to get your take on that.
Okay, I have no explanation for that whatsoever. The only dark spots that I know on the sun are sunspots, and the things that dance around would not be sunspots. They do move, but they move in much slower, and they grow and they recede. And as the sun turns around, you'll see them move, but they don't flicker and dance and do all the things you're suggesting there. So I've not heard that report from, for example, from this satellites that are observing the sun in great detail. You would think they might show up on those as well. So whether it's something in your instrumentation or the way you're taking the pictures, I don't know. I really don't have an explanation for it.
David, they think they might have, I'll put that in quotes, some organic compounds on Mars, though they think it could have been contamination as well, so they're not sure. But, you know, it would not surprise me if most of our planets were laden with some kind of life.
Yeah, because it's a long jump from organic chemicals to life.
It sure is.
You might expect to find organic chemicals on Mars, if only because they're delivered on meteorites. You know, meteorites can be rich in organic material, but they don't get much beyond amino acids, which are really just very primitive building blocks of life. So even if we do find organics on Mars, which you might eventually expect, then, you know, there's a lot of jumps in the series before you get to life, but it would be an exciting first step. I think that there's a chance for life underground on Mars. I'm suspecting that maybe the surface is possibly sterile. I'm thinking the life might be underground, but there's many other places in the solar system, as you talk about Europa, the moons of Jupiter and Saturn, and other places we're finding to be possible habitats for life.
Next up, let's go to Brandon and Napoleon, Ohio, first-time caller. Hello, Brandon, go ahead.
Hey, George. Hey, David. How's everything?
Good.
All right, good.
Hey, I just had a question. I was reading about this Baptistina family of asteroids in the asteroid belt. And, okay, a long story short, I see that, you know, when I started digging into this, it is highly unlikely. I mean, it's way more unlikely than you know, I first suspected of any sort of, you know, unforeseen impact with the Earth. But if you look at this Baptistina family of asteroids is blamed, theoretically, on two different large-scale impacts, the one in the Yucatan and possibly Chesapeake Bay, all right? So I'm thinking, okay, this one family of asteroids, I mean, the odds of that seem, you know, pretty unlikely. So what I'm wondering is you know, with the Lagrangian point or gravitational keyhole of the Earth and the fact that remnants of that Baptistina family of asteroids, remnants of it are still out there, what's the odds of you know, having another impact from that group of asteroids?
Okay, well, I know what you're talking about there, and that group of asteroids is in the main asteroid belt, which itself is not a threat to us because they go around in stable orbits beyond the orbit of Mars. The problem is if you get collisions between asteroids in the asteroid belt, which then throws fragments into the inner solar system, which is probably what happened with those two impacts you talked about. So in the past, two of those asteroids possibly collided, or some other object collided with one of them, broke them into fragments and sent them on paths into the inner solar system, so they eventually collided with the Earth. Now, it's possible that there are other fragments of those still floating around the Sun, and they would be in this community of asteroids that we call near-Earth asteroids. And remember I said there's about 9,000 of those known now. Some of those could be from that source, and there could be many other asteroids of the near-Earth family we don't know about. There's no reason why they would be on a collision course with the Earth any more than any of the other near-Earth asteroids. So I don't think that is going to be necessarily a particular source of a problem in the future. It just adds to the overall number of asteroids that are going around the Sun fairly close to the Earth.
Kevin in Warsaw, New York, it's your turn. Hey, Kevin, thank you for calling.
Hi, George. I'll be quick.
Okay, that's right.
First of all, I'd like to thank Coast to Coast. I've been listening for about 10 years now.
Thank you.
I still have my birth recorder and all that. But it really got me into the UFO phenomena. I mean, I pretty much read everything I could find and kind of almost got obsessed with it. But about December 21st, 2012, Dr. Turi had said that it's an end of an age of Pisces. And the age of Aquarius is here. Like Davenport has said, the UFO sightings are three times the norm.
That's right.
For 2012. And Dr. Turi has said, Aquarius is about the unbelievable, the unimaginable. Shock, shocking weather, shocking technology, shock, UFOs. And I think these ancient cultures, the Mayans, whatever, I mean, I knew things about astrology that we're finding out now, I mean, recently, and they left it in stone, and I think we should pay attention to that. About this, he said there's a golden gate. We're going to be given an opportunity. I think the UFO thing, the whole phenomena, is picking up, and we're going to see this unraveling. But a scenario I see, George, is the Middle East. We know these UFOs have been interested in our nukes.
Oh, sure. For years.
From the beginning.
For years.
Now, Jesus or Christ is supposed to descend in the Middle East. I almost see a scenario with nukes over there and an offering coming them. Because I don't really think they'll let humans use nukes.
Well,
if you
believe, Kevin, in you know, end times and revelation, people say that it's happening right now. I don't know how spiritual you get, David, but strange things are happening.
Well, the caller there has mentioned many, many different things, some of which may be related and some aren't. I'm not sure there was actually a question in there, but
no.
Things are happening, yes. Things are changing. That's a very general statement. I mean, the fact that there are more UFO observations this year could be due to the public excitement in the 2012 phenomenon. People are looking for things that might be happening this year. And if you are looking up in the skies and you think something might be happening, you might be more inclined to interpret innocent objects as UFOs. That's just a scientist, that's a skeptic talking, isn't it? But it's the only thing I could specifically comment on what he's said there. From your general question, am I a spiritual person? Yes, I am. And that goes beyond the logic of science. But if anybody tells me specific things, theories, you know, this is this, then I have to go into kind of a analytical mode. But in general, I am a spiritual person, and I believe there are things out there that are beyond the realm of materialistic science. Yeah.
I think so, too. Dan is in Grand Junction, Colorado, on the wild card line. Daniel, go ahead.
Hey, George, how you doing?
Good, Danny.
Good, good. Hey, I just wanted to bring up something real quick and just kind of get your thoughts on this. I've done quite a bit of research and stuff on the internet about this 2012 thing. And, you know, I hear so many people, they keep bringing up the Mayans, say that this is going to happen. The Mayans are going to, you know what I mean.
Sure.
Anyways, there's so many other cultures out there that have the exact same date. You know, for example, the Hopis and the Hopi prophecy rock. I don't think they necessarily speak of the world ending itself, but they say that we could go on one of two paths on that date. And, you know, so some of the other things, I don't know how true the whole Chinese I Ching is either, but apparently a mathematical deal showed up that, you know, they have the same date as December 21st. And I guess the same thing would be more or less with the WebBot project, too, also mm-hmm. shows that date. And I was just trying to figure out why everybody keeps pointing to only the Mayans talking about this and when, you know, everyone else is showing the exact same date. This appears to be a very global thing.
Well, this is a celestial event, isn't it, David?
Well, it's a celestial event if you believe in the galactic alignment thing. You know, and we've already talked about that and the sort of science behind that. It's an annual event in the sense that it's the winter equinox. I'm not sure there's anything in science that says that December 21st, 2012 is a special date. Most of the stuff that we're hearing about is beyond the realm of conventional science. I would have to say that, you know, that there is nothing in mainstream science that says there's something going to happen on that date. In any event, we're going to find out in 2 weeks' time, aren't we?
We sure are. And then what do we do afterward?
Exactly.
That's the question. David, stay with us. We're going to come back in just a moment with final phone calls. David Darling, our special guest, Split Show, his website linked up at coasttocoastam.com. It is truly a remarkable pleasure to talk with David Darling, great mind, a British astronomer. Back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Well, next hour with our Split Show, do the Iranians possess flying saucer technology? We're going to talk a little bit about that. Hey, by the way, if you're by your computer, or just remember this, go to coasttocoastam.com. Under the highlights reel, click the video excerpt, if you would, and you'll be able to see a little clip of our new television show, Beyond Belief. We are debuting the program on Friday, December 14th. It is free for you and this entire network for 10 days. So take advantage of it. They purchased Universal's DVD library, so they've got all kinds of specialized videos there that are part of this program. Go take a look at it. You'll enjoy it. But peek at our TV show, Beyond Belief, with me. And we've got a number of guests that you are going to know very, very well. But we've got a little clip for you at coasttocoastam.com. George Norrie back with you and David Darling and your phone calls as well. David, how did you get involved in science and astronomy?
Oh, that takes me right back to when I was about 5 years old, I think. My dad brought home this set of encyclopedias, and it was always the space section that I turned to first of all, just the pictures. You know, it was just the pictures of, they were reconstructions of the moon's surface and what other planets might be like. And this is, of course, at the, you know, late 50s, so almost before the space age began. And ever since then, I've just been fascinated by it. I don't know what it's sparked off the interest, but it goes way back.
Well, it's amazing how when we're kids, it has such an influence on us when we become adults.
It lasts a lifetime, doesn't it? And especially if you have somebody close to you that also inspires you and encourages your interest and allows you to follow your the path that you've chosen, which I was fortunate enough to have in my parents. So it was just something that happened. And maybe I was made to be a scientist. Actually, I really count myself as a science writer more than a scientist because I'm not actually practicing research scientist, but I like to see the big picture. That's why I became a writer rather than a researcher. Mm-hmm. But science is fascinating to me.
We know the magnetic poles are shifting. How far can they shift, and what will happen?
Well, the magnetic poles can reverse. In other words, they can switch places. North becomes south, and south becomes north. And this has happened many times in the past.
So if you've got a compass, and it normally shows you where north is, it'll flip it around?
It'll flip it around. And, yeah. It's happened in the past. We know from core samples that the geology studies of the magnets have been in rocks that this happens. It's unpredictable. It doesn't happen on a regular basis. The mechanism behind it is not well understood either, because we don't really know exactly what's inside the Earth. It's funny that we know more about other planets in many ways than we do about the interior of our own planet. We know it has something to do with motions, fluid motions of the metallic core. And at some point, for some reason, the poles can just flip around fairly quickly. It may happen over a period of just a couple of years. Now, in the past, this has happened, and we're still here. Life is still here. So obviously, it doesn't finish us off. But we don't know exactly what the consequences would be, say, if it happened next year or the year after. One of the problems would be that it would affect the Earth's magnetic field, and for a while that would be disturbed. So it's possible that more radiation from space would arrive on the surface. So there could be some problems for us.
Okay, let's go to the phones. We'll go back to Oregon now. Derek's with us west of the Rockies. Hey, Derek, go ahead.
Hey, George, David, great show tonight.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I've got a story I want to tell you guys and get your take on it. I've been a police officer for the past 7 years, and UFO calls are something we deal with on a regular basis. And I've noticed there's a huge increase in the calls from credible people that you just can't ignore this from. And this summer, I had my own experience that just kind of changed my whole outlook on the entire thing. And me and my wife were on the Eastern Oregon Desert, and we were hunting. And we were on this ridge system at the end of the day to call our son, because it's the only place you have service. And it overlooks just this massive alkali lake out on the desert. And we noticed that day, like, all the animals that we were seeing were acting, like, really erratic. And the only time we see them act that way before is, like, if there's an earthquake coming or something. And so I pull up there to this ridge, and I turn off my pickup, and I see two lights about 500 yards out in the sky, and they were brown, which I thought was kind of weird. But you know, there's a lot of Air Force activity in the skies over Eastern Oregon, and I'm like, that's strange. But I didn't really think nothing of it. But then the lights went away, and this ridge system's about 25 miles long, and then not even 2 seconds later, those lights were 10 miles away down the ridge about, and they started moving in a way that a plane wouldn't move, and then they separated from each other. And I pointed it out to my wife at this time, who was at this point telling me to get the hell out of there. But my curiosity was getting the best of me, and I turned on my truck, and my lights automatically come on when I do that. And those lights disappeared again. And I kid you not, when I did that, they reappeared not even 200 yards off of where we were at on this ridge system. And I had a rifle with me with a scope on it that it cost more than the rifle. And I threw it on there because it's good for night. And like, all I could see was black around these lights, and they totally separated, and they just started doing like weird movements. And then all of a sudden they disappeared, and then I see a regular plane coming by. It's like they got out of there because a regular plane was coming through. I mean, my wife was wigging on me, but I just wanted to get you guys' intake on that.
Would you be shocked, David, if we were being visited now?
No, I wouldn't be shocked at all. I mean, it's a reasonable possibility because you know, we study other cultures on Earth, don't we? And if there's something more advanced than ours, it would make sense that it would try to observe us, not necessarily get involved in our activities, but to watch us and monitor us and learn more about what we were doing. So I think that's perfectly reasonable. There's nothing crazy about that at all. And this particular incident, this personal incident, just been recounted to us here. There's no obvious explanation for that. I trust what he's saying, that he's not making this up. He sounds perfectly genuine, and there's obviously some phenomenon out there. I would question how he knows the distance of them, because he mentioned initially 500 yards, mm-hmm. and they were 10 miles away. I don't know what basis you could
right.
make that.
500 yards, maybe 10 miles, I wouldn't guess. I'd be way off on that.
Yeah. I mean, usually you can kind of triangulate if it's close to you. You can kind of almost move your head and see that they're close. But if it's 10 miles off, are they 20 miles off? Is it 1 mile off? I don't know. So there is that. I don't know whether you can judge distances unless you've got some frame of reference to compare. Because you don't know how big they are. That's the thing. You know, you don't know how big they are. So you don't really know how far away they are. But that's the only thing I would say is that would have to be established before you could come to and say, well, what is this? But I can't connect that with any phenomenon that I'm familiar with.
Let's go to Camarillo, California. Tim's been waiting. Hey, Tim, go ahead.
Hey, guys, great show tonight. I'd like to possibly say something. With all the planets that are apparently in the galaxies, and with all these galaxies that are abounding, and you have to consider the fact that there has to be intelligent life other than our own. So my question is not only where do we go as a species, and how do we fit in with intelligence that must be abounding in this universe, that must be greater than ours, considering the age of our solar system and considering the age of the universe that we know of, that it's to be, and how the possibility of life that has been there before ours even existed here in this solar system. And so the question is two-part. Is one, is where do you think that we are going to go as a species? How do you think we're going to fit in? And the second question is, with life that's so abounding on this planet, it's not just humanity that we must consider. It's what about all the other life forms that are here? Are they to evolve, or is our solar system in an arena of a clarity? In other words, let me rephrase: we have Jupiter, we have Saturn, we have the big planets that with the gravitational field tends to clear the asteroids out and the comets out away from this planet. So we've been existing here for so long. And do you think that there's much more time here that we have?
Okay. Well, where are we heading, I suppose, was your first part of your mm-hmm. question. And I personally think, and it may sound scary to some people, but I think that we are evolving towards a sort of machine intelligence. I don't kind of mean like the Borg on Star Trek, but we're not evolving biologically nearly as fast as we are evolving technologically. And if you look at the speed at which computers, for example, are developing, it's phenomenal. And our interaction with computers and with the World Wide Web and mobile phones and that kind of thing, we're linking together as a planet. Our separate minds, as it were, are becoming joined through this system. And it's not going to be very long before there are neural interfaces, so brain-computer links. And at that point, I believe, in given time, and I'm really talking about centuries rather than millions of years, I think there's going to be some sort of planetary mind evolving that is a fusion of the biology and the technology. And I believe that if there are other intelligent species out there, they may have already followed that path. So what we may find in the future is technological intelligence, at least looking at the course we're taking at the moment. So that might be a frightening possibility to many, but it and this is also being considered by mainstream scientists as well. you look at the people that are doing the searches for ETI out there, extraterrestrial intelligence, they also believe that a lot of what we find may be technological minds. So I think we're possibly on that course. Not sure if that's a welcoming thought or not, but I think it may be happening.
David, what do you think of Sitchin's theory that we were seeded by ETs?
Well, it's not just his theory. That is again something that's been discussed, and it's been discussed that maybe that's something we will do in the future. That may be a way that we will spread through the galaxy,
sure.
Not in person, but by sending our genetic material out there and seeding other planets. So, as a broad comment, it's not out of the question that although you on top of that, you can see, if you look at the fossil record on Earth, you can see how humans have evolved from lower species. So, but maybe he's talking about some sort of infusion of genetic material at some point that has accelerated our development. It's not out of the question. It's not an unreasonable idea.
If we launched some of our DNA and landed it on other planets, given millions and millions of years, would it form creatures like us?
No, I don't think it would. It probably would die out, because DNA on its own can't survive. It has to be in the form of reproducing cells,
okay,
for one thing.
Okay.
So you'd have to actually send the cellular material. Then it would have to be able to exist in whatever environment it found itself. But the possibilities for evolution are so diverse that it's incredibly unlikely that you would get anything closely resembling humans if you repeated that history.
Okay, next up we go to James in Jacksonville, Florida, first-time caller. Hey, James, go ahead.
Hi. Hey, George, big fan.
Thank you, sir.
Mr. Darling, you are an incredible thinker, and I really appreciate the chance to chat with you.
No.
My idea is, and I've read untold number of books about this subject, if we could build, and we can build it because we built the space station, if we could build two or three ships outside of the atmosphere up there with the space station, fill it up with willing people ready to travel, give them enough ships on those vessels to get out there, and when they get far enough away, it might take several generations, but I don't see an issue with that. I really don't. Build a ship big enough so that they can live in there. I live on a sailboat in Jacksonville, Florida, and I know what it's like living in an enclosed space. It can be done.
Mm-hmm.
It can be done if willing minds are ready to give it a shot. So if you send the ships out, and I'm gonna segue to the seeding issue. You send them out, give them enough equipment to see what's out there. It can be done. And I would like to hear your response on that.
All right.
Well, basically, you're talking about travel to other stars here, I assume, beyond the solar system. So what we're really talking about here is the space arc concept, the generational
ship. That's right.
Where people live and die, and basically it's a self-contained world, and that's reasonable. I think again you've got to make sure that the willing population, you've got to be prepared to live and die out your lives on this, and with no prospect of getting there except.
And how many people would do that?
Well, there might be a few, but I'm not sure they would be necessarily normal people. I would find it a difficult concept to do, because you've got to think not just of yourselves, but also of your offspring, that you're going to be bringing children into this very tiny world and having them live and die in a small environment. Now, they would have the excitement of traveling through space, but with nothing to see except very, very remote points of light. It makes you wonder, is that an environment you would want to raise your children on? Unless it was a very, very large thing, almost like a miniature planet, so that you had all of the facilities of a planet. But it seems that would be a long shot. It'd be much smaller than that. The other thing is whether something so small, without a sun nearby, would actually be capable of existing over a long period of time. Now, you say, you know, it happened where you are, that it's possible to, but you're not isolated from the rest of the ecosystem on Earth. You never are. You've still got the sun in the sky. You've got everything is interacting. On this little miniature world, everything would have to be very self-contained. So I think there are issues about whether it could keep going over a long period of time. I think it possibly could, but I think the issue would be whether people would be willing to do that.
And would they? Let's go to Debbie, Manhattan, New York. Squeeze a couple more calls here for you. David, go ahead, Debbie.
Hi, how are you? Great
Good.
Show tonight.
Thank you.
A couple of topics to touch. UFO sightings. There's been more sightings in recent times. And it says in the Bible that we are not fighting against flesh and blood, but against wicked spiritual forces in the heavenly world.
Some think that. That's true.
And Noah, you know, it's because the previous caller was just talking about living in tight quarters and limited environment. But didn't Noah supposedly, with his daughters and son-in-laws and all these animals, spend a long amount of time?
40 days, I think, wasn't it?
Well, yeah, that's what the Bible says, 40 days. But how do we know that it was actually 40 days?
Maybe it was 40 years. Who knows?
Yeah, and how do we know that he actually remained on water, that he wasn't in a vessel or some kind of a craft? They'll specify.
That's possible. David, we're almost out of time. What's new with you? Where you go? Do you speak?
I was speaking down in London a couple of weeks ago, and also I'm heavily involved in writing an album of music at the moment, which I'm trying to capture the same thoughts I put into my books.
Really?
Music, and release that in April, so maybe we can talk about that.
Oh, cool.
Play a tune maybe next time.
Absolutely. All right, David, thanks so much. Have a great holiday.
Okay, thank you. Good luck on the 21st.
Yeah, we'll be here. I think we'll be here Saturday, Sunday, and you name it. It's David Darling. Up next, Sterling Allen joins me. His book, Breakthrough Powers, but we're talking about analyzing a video of a saucer-like craft intercepting what could be a U.S. drone. We'll talk about that.